dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse.
Now, all of these childhood conditions are characterized by fairly common features of poor social skills, poor reading of social cues, poor impulse control. And neither the behavioral model nor the genetic disease model allows us to fully understand these conditions. I'm going to suggest to you the only perspective through which to actually understand human beings is what has been called a biopsychosocial perspective. And this is true whether we're looking at cancer, whether we're looking at addiction, or whether we're looking at childhood behaviors. Now, the biopsychosocial perspective simply means that the biology of human beings is actually affected throughout the lifetime by the psychological and social environment. This biopsychosocial perspective demands not only that we look at the immediate parenting environment, but also that we look at the broader social environment, which, by the way, is why we have such a problem accepting it. Because it's much easier to blame individuals for their behavior than to look at the broad social picture. And it's much easier to look at genes and say that they're the problem than to look at the broader social picture. Because as an American writer put it, let me just quote this, it's all in the genes is an explanation for the way things are that does not threaten the way things are.
We soon will be riding my shiny black bed.
You're listening to episode 653 of Unwelcome Guests, The Biopsychosocial Approach. I'm Robin Upton, and you just heard Dr. Gabor Maté speaking on April the 12th, 2012, to the Parent Child Center of Tulsa, giving a talk he entitled The Biology of Loss. Now, this is a 2.5 hour talk squeezed into just under 2 hours by removing a lot of hesitation and a bit of audience participation. So I haven't got a lot more time to speak. Suffice it to say that, as a follow-on to last week, this talk exemplifies how certain fairly obvious areas of research are sidelined, ignored, obfuscated, because they challenge the status quo and the myths necessary to motivate people to go along with the story of the discrete and separate self engaged in a perpetual struggle of self-advancement by fighting everyone and everything.
Let me tell you what my first, what my interest in this whole subject is. It came from a number of streams. One is that in family practice, you see families, and after a while, if your eyes are open, you begin to notice that who gets into trouble and who doesn't, who gets sick and who doesn't. It's not accidental. There are certain patterns that you start to notice. And this is true whether you're talking about ADHD or mental illness or cancer in a family. You just start seeing that there are certain patterns. These are the things that nobody teaches you in medical school. Secondly, in my own personal life, I was a successful doctor, but things weren't going well. I myself was severely depressed and had to be treated with Prozac. Diagnosed with ADHD in my early 50s. I'll tell you about that later. My kids were having problems. So there was that personal incentive to figure things out. And then working in palliative care, people at the end of life. And again, I began to see that who ends up in palliative care with cancer wasn't accidental. There were certain family patterns. And then finally, for 12 years, I worked in Vancouver's downtown east side, near Vancouver, British Columbia, North America's most concentrated area of drug use. And even people coming from some of the inner cities of the United States, when they visit Vancouver, are quite shocked to see hundreds of people in a few square block radius injecting outdoors, needles, syringes in the streets, people rummage around for stuff in back alleys. So I worked there for 12 years, and for 2 years, I was a doctor at North America's only supervised injection site, where drug addicts actually get to bring their drugs and inject under supervision, clean needles, sterile water, sterile swabs, and under nursing supervision, so if they overdose, they get resuscitated. It's highly controversial in some circles, modality, and the Canadian government tried to shut the place down. Just last November, the Canadian Supreme Court, by a unanimous 9-0 decision, upheld the right of the place to stay open and forbade the government from shutting it down. But it remains a unique facility, and for 2 years I was a physician there. So I bring to this work my personal stuff, very much having had to look at my own life and just why things weren't working, and also my experience delivering a lot of babies, closing the eyes of people at death, and everything else in between. And amidst all that, I had to discover a lot of the literature, a lot of the research that has been done now. I'll introduce it to you. It has been done, it has been validated, it's not controversial, but it's not yet taught in medical schools. It's not taught in schools of education. It's not taught in schools of social work, psychology, and so on. And what I'm saying to you today is that in medical practice, certainly, there's this slogan of evidence-based practice. We're supposed to base our practice on the evidence. Well, we don't. There's a lot of evidence that we completely ignore, and it leaves us bereft. Now, this morning I'll be talking about childhood development, and what I call the biology of loss, and I'll explain that to you. The phrase comes from an American researcher who points out that when children don't get certain things in their lives, that changes the biology of the child. So he says there must be a biology of loss, and we must find it, he said. So that's where the title comes from. There must be a biology of loss. Well, there is a biology of loss. But that's not the dominant perspective. Now, when we look at childhood behavior on this continent, we basically have two approaches. One approach is the behavioral approach. In other words, we just look at the behavior, and we don't like the behavior, so we simply try to change the behavior. So in Toronto, Canada, Toronto, Ontario, in last June, there was an infamous incident of a 9-year-old boy, grade 3 in other words, who ends up in handcuffs in school. What happened was, this boy has Asperger's. Now, Asperger's is on this autism spectrum range of disorders, and it's characterized typically by poor social skills, so not reading social cues, and poor impulse control. And kids with Asperger's, as all these kids, are more likely to be bullied. Now, he was bullied, and he gets upset, and he starts screaming. Well, the teachers think that the best way to deal with this is to isolate him. We have this idea in North America that the way you deal with kids in trouble is to isolate them. And the whole timeout technique that all you know so well is based on isolating kids. And I'll be talking to you about that later. So this kid is put in the room by himself, at which point he completely loses it. And he starts destroying furniture and all that. So then they call the police. And the police enter the room and they put him in handcuffs, just for 30 seconds or so. The media debate was, did the police do the right thing in handcuffing a 9-year-old? But that was the wrong question. Because when you're going to call the police, they're going to do what the police are trained to do, which is to restrain. That's what they know how to do. The real question was, why did the school so completely lack the understanding of the dynamics of this 9-year-old that they did exactly the opposite of what he needed? Just when he needed human contact, they isolated. But that's the behavioral approach. We have a behavior we don't like. Let's isolate the behavior. Let's deal with the behavior. Now, you'll be not surprised to know that this is not unique to Canada. A similar incident occurred in a Florida place, which actually made the New York Times a few years ago, where a 6-year-old in a kindergarten ended up being charged with assault. And what happened was that this kid got upset about something in the classroom and he hid under the table. The teachers tried to pull him out and he kicked at them. So they called the police. And the police ended up arresting him and charging him with assault. And the New York Times reporter phones the police chief in this small Florida town to say, but this kid is only 6 years old. And the police chief says, why, do you think this is the first 6-year-old we arrested in this town? I know that's an extreme example, these both are, but they highlight the behavioral approach, where we focus on the behavior. In fact, we have this phrase called acting out. We talk about kids acting out. Now, when I say somebody's acting out, what do you see in your mind's eye? What do you imagine? Aggression and so on. Right, so when I say the phrase acting out, you think of a kid doing something bad. Now think of the actual English phrase, acting out. It has a very specific meaning, and we should certainly understand it, and we should use the phrase in its proper context. To act out means to portray in behavior something you haven't got the words to say in language. So, in a game of charades, when you're not allowed to speak, what do? You have to act it out. If you landed in a country where nobody spoke your language and you had to portray your hunger or your fatigue, you have to act it out. You have to make motions of eating with your mouth and hands and so on. So you have to act it out. So let's consider that acting out is actually the right phrase, but we have to understand it rightly. What I'm saying to you today is that let's not focus on behaviors. Let's look at what those behaviors are portraying. Because all these behaviors are not the problem. The behaviors are simply the symptoms of a problem. Trying to fix the behavior, like trying to fix bullying by zero tolerance approaches just doesn't work. Because we're not getting at what the bullying is all about. So that's the behavioral approach. And the behavioral approach dominates North American thinking. It dominates, of course, our approach to drug use. And I'll be speaking about addictions this afternoon. But the whole idea behind the so-called war on drugs is that people are behaving badly, and what we have to do is to deter them from that behavior, or to punish them if we haven't succeeded in deterring them. So it's consistent. We treat kids in this behavioral way, and then we treat adults the same way. And the behavioral approach is based on psychological work that was done by B.F. Skinner and his associates in the 1940s, where you basically took rats in a laboratory, and if you wanted a rat to behave in a certain way, you did one of two things. You either punished him for the wrong behavior, or you rewarded him for the right behavior. So if you wanted a rat to go to a certain part of a cage, you'd put sugar cubes there. And if you wanted to deter him, you'd put electricity in the bottom of the cage so you get a shock. Skinner didn't care what was in the mind of the rat. Basically, the mind to him was what he called a black box. It was just considered a concern with manipulating behaviors. And he said, give me a child and I can make anything out of him. So the assumption is that kids are blank slates and you can just program them into whatever behavior you want by manipulating the external rewards or punishments. But that's the one approach to child behavior. But the second approach, of course, is the medicalization of childhood, which we're seeing increasingly now. So just this morning, I was reading the New York Times, and in Arkansas, Johnson & Johnson, a major pharmaceutical company, has been fined $1.2 billion for the false advertising of an antipsychotic medication called Risperidone. Risperidone is one of these modern so-called atypical antipsychotics. It's being given to adults with schizophrenia, and a lot of kids are getting it for autism and for behavior problems. And it can cause obesity, diabetes, heart disease, personality changes, and so on. So much so that in Vancouver, British Columbia, where I live, the British Columbia Children's Hospital has had to establish a special clinic just to deal with the effects of the antipsychotics on kids. In the United States, there are 3 million children, over 3 million now, getting stimulant medications for ADHD. Over 500,000 kids are getting these antipsychotic medications, and we have no idea what the antipsychotics will actually do in the long term, because there's been no long-term research on the effects of on the developing brain of antipsychotics. But we have hundreds of thousands of children getting these medications. And we're not giving it to kids to control their psychosis, because they're not psychotic. We're giving it to them to control their behaviors. So what we've got in this country and on this continent is this massive social experiment in the chemical control of children's brains, without any scientific evidence that A, it's useful, or B, that it's harmless. And that's because if we can't explain things behaviorally, that the problem is the behavior, then we say it must be a medical problem. So a large number of kids, so there's an article somebody just gave me from a local newspaper about autism, and the New York Times this last weekend about the burgeoning diagnosis of autism, so that 1 in 88 kids are now said to have autism, and 1 in 10 meet the diagnostic criteria for ADHD, to the point that the American Academy of Pediatrics a few months ago actually recommended that we start screening and, if necessary, medicating four-year-olds for ADHD. And the belief, of course, is that what we're dealing with is a whole bunch of genetic diseases. So that we either have the behavior model of bad behavior, let's fix it, or we have the model of a disease, let's medicate it. Now, of course, when you think about it, the genetic model doesn't work. Because anything that's genetic doesn't increase that quickly. If we're seeing a lot more kids, it's not because there's a genetic epidemic somehow. Either we're overdiagnosing, or we're better at diagnosing, or we're seeing many more troubled kids. But whatever the reason is, it can't be that it's a spread of genetic disease. That just doesn't cut it. Genes don't change in a population over 10 years, 30 years, 40 years, even 400 years. So if we're seeing 30 times as many kids with autism now as we did 30, 40 years ago, whatever it is, it can't be genetic disease. Now, all of these childhood conditions are characterized by fairly common features of poor social skills, poor reading of social cues, poor impulse control. And neither the behavioral model nor the genetic disease model allows us to fully understand these conditions. I'm going to suggest to you the only method or the only perspective through which to actually understand human beings is what has been called a biopsychosocial perspective. And this is true whether we're looking at cancer, whether we're looking at addiction, or whether we're looking at childhood behaviors. Now, the biopsychosocial perspective simply means that the biology of human beings is actually affected throughout the lifetime by the psychological and social environment. So we're not saying that things aren't biological. ADHD is biological, let me tell you. I can totally tell you that. It's with me all the time. You know, yesterday when Desiree drives into my hotel and I get up to my hotel room and the key doesn't work and I can't get into my hotel room. So I go down to the front desk and the problem is simply that my hotel room is not 522 but 1522. I just don't notice the one. So I go to the wrong floor. And 3 weeks ago when I was speaking in Edmonton, Alberta, as I was this week as well, and I lose my CD case with my music and I get to Massachusetts where I'm speaking there without the CDs. And then I lose my cord to my computer there. And when I leave from the airport, somebody has to run after me with my laptop. That's my ADHD showing up all the time. You know, so let me tell you, it's biological. What I'm saying is that the biology is affected by the psychological and social environment. And let me give you three examples of that, what I mean by biopsychosocial. And I'm not talking about behaviors here, I'm actually talking about physical illnesses here. So it's been shown, for example, that children whose parents are stressed are more likely to have asthma. So the more stress on the parent, the greater the risk of asthma in the child. Now you might think, what does stress on the parent have to do with the lungs of the child? But you know, the answer is really obvious, even though it completely eludes most physicians. It has to do with physiology. And our human physiology interacts with the environment. Now, has anybody here been treated for asthma? Yeah? Remember what you got for your asthma? Inhalers. Do you know what was in them? Steroid and, yeah. Basically what happens in asthma is you get narrowing of the airways so that the bronchi, which are the airways, the smooth muscle that surrounds them goes into spasm. So now you have a narrow tube through which the air has to move in and out. And the other aspect of asthma is inflammation of the airways. So you get swelling and clutter, further obstructing the flow of air. Now, to reverse the process, we give two inhalers. One of them is called the bronchodilator, which relaxes the muscle, allows the tube to open up again. And the other suppresses the inflammation. Now, the inhaler that suppresses the inflammation is a steroid, a corticosteroid. It's a copy of cortisol. And the inhaler that opens up the airways, the bronchodilator, is a copy of adrenaline. They're stress hormones. These are the hormones made by the adrenal gland. We have the kidney, so renal means kidney, adrenal means top of the kidney. So the adrenal gland is on top of the kidney and it puts out a couple of hormones in response to stress. One of them is named after it, adrenaline. And the adrenal gland has got a cortex like the brain. Cortex means bark, like the bark of a tree. And so it puts out a hormone named after it, called after cortex, cortisol. And adrenaline gives you more muscle strength, it sends blood to your muscles and it makes the heart beat faster so you have more oxygen flow, it raises your blood pressure so you have more power. Cortisol gives you more sugar so that you have more energy, which allows you to escape or to fight back, the flight or fight response. So these are stress hormones. Now, should the fact that we're treating asthma with stress hormones make us consider that it may have something to do with stress? Now, what's the connection between the parent's emotions and the child's asthma? Is that the child's physiology is actually influenced by the parent's emotional states. It's biopsychosocial. So when you're seeing an asthmatic child, it's not enough just to give them an inhaler. Ideally, you'd also look at the parent's stress levels. That's what it means to have a biopsychosocial perspective. And this obtains throughout the life cycle. Let me tell you about cancer. There was a study in Australia, and this is just one small example. They looked at 500 women who had lumps in their breasts, and they had to be biopsied to make sure it wasn't malignant. Now, before the results came back, the women underwent a psychological interview. It turned out at the end of the study that if the woman had a major stressful episode in her life, that by itself had zero impact on whether the lump was cancerous or not. Similarly, if a woman was emotionally isolated, that by itself had no impact, zero effect on whether or not that lump was cancerous. So far, so good. But if a woman was emotionally isolated and stressed, the risk of that lump being cancerous was 9 times as great as the average. Now, the researchers had great difficulty understanding this, because how does zero, logically speaking, how does 0 and 0 compute to 9? Logically, it doesn't make any sense if you're only thinking with the left side of your brain. If you were stressed right now, that'd be a physiological state. You'd have all this adrenaline and cortisol in your system. And that would be necessary so you could fight back or to escape. So in the short term, stress is just a response that helps you survive. It's an adaptation. But in the long term, those same stress hormones that in the short term help you survive, in the long term, if they continue at high levels in your system, undermine your health. Now think of a condition called high blood pressure. Hypertension, it's called, by the way. Do you think there's a relationship between too much tension in a person's life and their blood pressure? They've had too much adrenaline for too long. That's all. Now, the cortisol over the long term, in the short term it helps you, again, energize you, but in the long term it actually suppresses your immune system. So the same product that in the short term helps you survive, in the long term kills you. Now, if you are, by the way, you know, too much cortisol, you got ulcers, thins your bones, makes you depressed, gives you heart disease, and suppresses your immune system. So, now you're getting the picture. If you were emotionally isolated, that means that for months you'd be stewing your own stress juices with all this assault on your immune system. But what if somebody comes along early in the game and says, hey friend, how you doing? How you feeling? You want to talk about it? What happens to your physiology right away? You take a deep breath. Oxygen goes to your brain. Your hormone levels go down. Adrenaline abates. Cortisol abates. And you can go back into physiological balance. No wonder then that the women who were emotionally isolated and stressed were more likely to have cancer. Which means to say that cancer is not the disease of an individual person. It reflects something about their psychological and social relationships. What I'm trying to establish right now is that you can't separate the biology of human beings from the psychological and social environment. And at the end of life, there was a study in the New England Journal of Medicine just a few years ago that showed that in an elderly couple who've been together for a long time, when one of them is hospitalized, what do you suppose happens to the other one? They're more likely to fall sick. You know why? Because the immune system of the one depends on the social and emotional relationship with the other. That's the biopsychosocial perspective. It's just so obvious. Now, this is especially true in childhood. Why is it especially true in childhood? Because the child is so dependent. You see, the human child is the most dependent and the most immature and stays that way for the longest period of time than any other creature in the universe. So their biology, the child's biology, is very much affected by the parents. So that's the perspective that we'll be coming from. And a couple of months ago in the journal Pediatrics, which is the official publication of the American Pediatric Association, there was an article from a group called the Center for on the Developing Child at Harvard University, and they say that social and physical environments that threaten human development because of scarcity, stress, or instability can lead to short-term physiologic and psychological adjustments that are necessary for immediate survival and adaptation, but which make them a significant cause to long-term outcomes in learning, behavior, health, and longevity. Now, to put that into more plain language, what they're saying is that the adaptations of the child that help you survive childhood adversity in the short term become source of pathology later on. So that instead of thinking that people are inheriting illnesses or behaving badly, what we're actually looking at is the child's short-term attempt to survive stress. And those adaptations that help them survive stress in the short term become the source of dysfunction later on. So that's the biopsychosocial perspective. Now that has huge implications for how we deal with children. Because if we see children's problems not as diseases that they inherited, and not as behavior issues that we have to correct, but as problems of development. In other words, if we recognize that whether you're looking at an adult, and by the way, Dr. Bessel van der Kolk, who is the world's leading expert on trauma, one of them, and he's a psychiatrist at Boston University, he says that 100% of the inmates of the U.S. criminal justice system were traumatized children, or nearly 100%. If we see the problem, not in terms of disease or behavior, but in terms of development, in other words, if we're seeing that the conditions for development were not right, it also means that when we're working with these kids, or for that matter, when we're working with the adults, the question we should be asking ourselves is, not how do we correct behaviors, and not how do we treat symptoms, but how do we promote the right kind of development? Because the good news is that the human brain and human organism can develop even later on in life, given the right conditions. And so the word for that is neuroplasticity. Neuro meaning the nervous system, plasticity meaning its capacity for new development. And as I'll be telling you, human beings retain that neuroplastic capacity for a lifetime, even in old age, in many cases. And that means that the question we need to be asking ourselves is, what conditions do people need for healthy development? Now, if a plant wasn't growing in your backyard, you'd have two options. You can go out there and yell at it. Grow up already. You know, you're a year old. You look like a three-month-old. What's wrong with you? At your age. You could do that. Or more likely, you would ask yourself, what conditions are missing here? Soil, nutrition, irrigation, sunlight. And instead of yelling at the plant, you'd be providing the right conditions. You wouldn't necessarily be asking yourself, what disease does the plant have? Well, it's the same with kids. And I submit to you, it's the same with adults for that matter. The question we need to be asking ourselves is, what are the healthy conditions for development? Which is a very different question from how do you control behaviors and how do you treat symptoms. Now, by the way, there's nothing new about this perspective. This biopsychosocial perspective that now modern science has fully validated, it's certainly not a new concept. 2,500 years ago, the Buddha, who was one of the great psychologists in history, he had this concept called interdependent co-arising. Interdependent co-arising means that no phenomenon arises on its own. So the Buddha said, look at a leaf or a raindrop, he says. A leaf, you might say, is a separate object, you know, just something in itself. But if you understood it only as an object in itself, you would not understand its true nature. Because its true nature is that it represents the whole world. Because the leaf obviously contains the sun, because of the sunlight. Photosynthesis wouldn't happen without sunlight. It contains the sky, because without irrigation, water, there would be no leaf. And the earth, obviously. So the Buddha said, contemplate the nature of interdependent co-arising during every moment. When you look at a leaf or a raindrop, meditate on all the conditions, near and distant, that have contributed to the presence of that leaf or raindrop. Know that the world is woven of interconnected strands. This is because that is. This is not because that is not. This is born because that is born. This dies because that dies. The birth and death of any phenomena, he says, are connected to the birth and death of all other phenomena. The one contains the many, and the many contains the one. Without the one, there cannot be the many. Without the many, there cannot be the one. And so, a modern follower of the Buddha, Thich Nhat Hanh, who's a Vietnamese monk, lives in France, but frequently comes to the States, says the following about the child, he says. When we see a child who is well behaved, we may understand the source and reason for his good behavior, is the ground that nurtured him, his community, and his family. It is even more important to see the interdependent, the co-arising nature of a child who's cruel. Just as with good behavior, the reasons for the child's cruelty can be found in his family, society, school, friends, and ancestors. If we do not shine the light of interdependent co-arising on the child's character, we get angry or afraid. And if we blame him, we must do our best to understand his interdependent self-nature in order to understand him, accept him, love him, and help him transform. And that's the perspective for which I intend to give you the scientific basis today. Now, intuitively, it's obvious really when you think about it. And that also means, by the way, that any phenomenon we look at, we have to apply that biopsychosocial perspective, that interdependent co-arising point of view, whether we're looking at crime, behavior problems, addictions, disease, we have to look at it from the broad context. And ultimately that means we have to actually look at the broad society that gives rise to those behaviors. I don't have to tell you, and not in Tulsa, not this week, for example, that there's still some significant problems in this country when it comes to race relations. Now, you can't understand that based on just looking at individual behaviors. You can't understand the fact that black people in this country make up a certain percentage of the population, but a much larger percentage of the prison population. You're not going to understand that trying to look at those individuals and trying to find fault with them. You're just not going to understand it. You're not going to understand why my country, the Native Indian Canadians, make up 5% of the population, but 40, 50% of the prison population. You're not going to understand that unless you look at history and broad social conditions. So this biopsychosocial perspective demands not only that we look at the immediate parenting environment, but also that we look at the broader social environment, which, by the way, is why we have such a problem accepting it. Because it's much easier to blame individuals for their behavior than to look at the broad social picture. And it's much easier to look at genes and say that they're the problem than to look at the broader social picture. Because as an American writer put it, let me just quote this, it's all in the genes is an explanation for the way things are that does not threaten the way things are. Why should someone feel unhappy or engage in antisocial behavior when that person is living in the freest and most prosperous nation on earth? By the way, let me tell you a fact that you may not realize. Americans make up 5% of the world's population, but 25% of the world's jail population. And that means that 1 in 4 people in the world in jail is a citizen of the land of the free. Now think about that one. And my country, Canada, is emulating that. Our government has just brought in legislation, prolonged sentences that gives judges less latitude for leniency, and so on, so that now they're spending billions of dollars on new jails, which money, of course, is not available for social services and prevention programs. So it's not just a U.S. problem. But anyway, why should someone feel unhappy or engage in antisocial behavior when that person is living in the freest and most prosperous nation on earth? It can't be the system. There must be a flaw in the wiring somewhere. So that these perspectives of blaming individuals on the one hand, or on the other blaming genes, they are not just, I think, misleading ideas, but they serve a social purpose. And you have to understand something about medicine and science. We think of science as something objective and independent, but really, medical science is a very much an ideological question. So that behind how we look at things is always an ideology, whether we realize it or not. And, of course, medical ideology is very much driven by, to some extent, by dominant forces. And one of the dominant forces, not the only one, is certainly the power of the pharmaceutical companies. And I'll say more about that later. But I'm not saying there's a conspiracy here, by the way, between doctors and the pharmaceutical companies, although sometimes there is. But that's not really what it is. What it is that research that's published in medical journals has to be funded. Who's got the money to fund research? It's the pharmaceutical companies. And that means that there's a bias towards what's pharmaceutical solution. And there's an automatic bias. Because if I said things are biopsychosocial, there's no money in that for anybody. So that's not the research that gets widely publicized. That's just one example of an ideological bias. Now, what that comes down to then is that we need to be looking at the environment. That's going to be the message the whole day. You have to look at the environment. That's difficult for parents. If I tell parents that their son's ADHD actually has to do with the parenting environment, no, they'll be, oh, are you blaming me? So that's more difficult for people to accept. But it's also much more liberating, considerate. Because if you were a parent, what would you rather hear? That your child has a genetic disease that's just how they're wired genetically, and there's nothing you can do about it except medicate them. Or if I said, you know, your child has a developmental problem because the conditions for development weren't quite right, but with the proper approach, you can actually help him grow out of it. I mean, what would you rather hear? Which is the more positive approach? Also, of course, it's also the more scientific approach. So that's the news here. And that means that for ourselves, as child care workers, as social workers, as teachers, parents, people in law enforcement, anybody that interacts with kids, with families, with young offenders, anybody, the question you need to be asking is not just how do we deal with the immediate behavior problem, but how do we promote this person's development in the long term? That's the question you need to be asking. Now, a big determinant of that, by the way, is who we are. So what I'll be telling you is that the biggest impact that we have on people is not based on what we do and what we say, but by what? How we relate to them, who we are at the moment. That is what has the greatest impact. And I've seen this, you know, even in the downtown east side of Vancouver, with adults addled by addiction. And I've seen this with police. When the police show up as hostile and authoritarian and uptight, the situation escalates and gets tense, and then there's problems. A different police man or woman who shows up with a sense of confidence in themselves and no hostility, a bit of a sense of humor, a bit of space around them, it diffuses the situation. So the same situation that can turn very ugly very quickly becomes instead very manageable simply by how that person shows up. Just how we show, even in an extreme situation. Now, with children who are much more malleable, much more still in a developmental stream, and much more open to be affected by the environment, that's the major determinant. It's just how we show up. Now, parenting in North America is seen as a set of skills. We talk about parenting skills. Let me tell you, parenting's got nothing to do with skills. Nobody teaches a mother bear parenting skills. Parenting has to do with the relationship. For example, we talk about oppositionality in kids. We actually diagnose a lot of kids with oppositional defiant disorder. Now let me show you the absurdity of that particular diagnosis. If my foot was broken right now, would it make any difference to that broken foot whether you were here in the room with me or whether I was by myself? Obviously not. My foot may be broken whether I was by myself or whether I was accompanied by 100 people. But could I be oppositional if I was here by myself? Now, if you don't know what I'm talking about, when you go home this afternoon, shut yourself into a room, make sure you're alone, and try and oppose somebody. Okay? And if you manage to do it, videotape it with you and put it on YouTube. Because you all want to know how you become oppositional when there's nobody else there. In other words, oppositionality implies a relationship. But if oppositionality implies a relationship, why are we diagnosing the child? Why aren't we looking at the child's relationship to the adult world? In other words, what I'm saying is that the first thing we have to look at, we show up. Just how we show up. Not just what ideas we have, or what our intentions are, or what skills we have. Those are important. But primarily, how do we show up for that child? Now, for that, we have to be aware of ourselves. We have to have some mindful awareness of who we are. We have to be taking care of ourselves. And it really behooves us to maintain that awareness of ourselves. Otherwise, we get triggered. And I know in the downtown instead of Vancouver, on a given day with my addicted clients, and these people are heavily into heroin and cocaine and crystal meth and whatever, but how the interaction goes doesn't depend on them. It depends on me. So on days when I'm irritable and stressed and maybe haven't had breakfast and maybe had a fight with my wife the night before, and I'm tense, everything goes badly. And then I say, why was everybody so in such a lousy mood today? Because I'm not aware of what I bring to the interaction. I'm generating that. I'm triggering that into people. And the more dependent people are, the more you can trigger them, you see, because the more hooked in they are to you. So children are very hooked into us. They're very much affected by us. So how we show up has a great impact on them. But we don't see that, you see. We just see their behavior. We're not seeing how their responses or their stance is very much affected by what we present ourselves. So we need to have that awareness of ourselves. With that in mind, I'm going to introduce just a mindfulness awareness exercise that I ask you to join me in for 7 minutes or so, and then I'll carry on with the lecture. So I'm going to ask you to get into a position where your feet are on the ground, so you're grounded, okay? And Steve, this will need the track two on that first CD. And in a moment, and your hands on your lap, either palms on top of each other with the thumbs touching, or just on your lap, shoulders straight, sitting straight up, comfortable, but you're not leaning backwards or hunched forward, as long as you're comfortable, eyes closed perhaps, or semi-closed, and I just invite you to be aware of your breath. With this chanting in the background, just be aware of your breath, in and out, and just notice what happens to your mind. What you'll notice, or what you'll not notice, is that your mind will automatically wander away. And when you become aware of the mind having wandered, just say, come back to the breath. So don't berate yourself, oh gee, I screwed it up, I didn't follow the breath. Don't do any of that, don't judge yourself. But just notice that you're gone and come back to the breath. And this is simply an exercise in promoting mindful awareness. Okay, Steve, please. It's not a bad idea to bring some mindful awareness into our life every day. Because again, it's who we are and how we show up that has the biggest impact on pretty much everything we do. And especially in interaction with children, because of the dependence of children. So in two of my books, I begin with the teaching of Krishnamurti, who was a spiritual teacher in the 70s, very well known, who said, action has meaning only in relationship. Without understanding relationship, action on any level will only breed conflict. The understanding of relationship is infinitely more important than the search for any plan of action. Now, that's kind of interesting because my book on ADHD, which is the first book that I wrote in Canada, the title was Scattered Minds, A New Look at the Origins and Healing of Attention Deficit Disorder. The American publisher called it Scattered. They dropped the word minds. They didn't think the American public would understand that word. I don't know why that is. But the same publisher then brought another book called Scattered Minds on the same subject, just to confuse things by a different doctor. But it's the subtitle that interests me, because the American subtitle was How Attention Deficit Disorder Originates and What You Can Do About It. So it's right away that, what can we do? What can we do? Canadian title said, A New Look. And I'm saying, well, let's look at something first. Let's actually understand it. Because how we respond to a problem has to do with how we understand it, how we see it. So the perception is much more important than the plan of action. And Krishnamurti says that the most important thing is relationship. With understanding relationship, any plan of action will only breed conflict. So it's from that perspective that we need to look at childhood behaviors. I'll tell you a little bit about ADHD, and the reason I start with that is A, because it's a good template for understanding all childhood developmental problems. And secondly, it's the one I'm very familiar with, having been diagnosed with it myself. So my own diagnosis, at the time I was the coordinator of the palliative care unit at the Vancouver Hospital, working with terminally ill people, and the social worker on the unit, Betsy Jo Spicer, a 38 years old woman, asked to have coffee with me. And she was all excited. I said, sure, let's have coffee. So we did. And she told me she'd just been diagnosed with adult ADHD, which I didn't know existed, really. Nobody told me about that. But 3 minutes into the conversation, I realized why it was with me that she wanted to have coffee. Because everything she said about herself, I recognized about myself. So I just got it. You know, this is it. So let me read to you from the first chapter of my book, Scattered. To dip my toe in was to know that unawares I had been immersed in it all my life up to my neck. This realization may be called the stage of ADD epiphany, the Annunciation, characterized by elation, insight, enthusiasm, and hope. It seemed to me that I had found a passage to those dark recesses of my mind from which chaos issues without warning, hurling thoughts, plans, emotions, and intentions in all directions. I felt I had discovered what it was that had always kept me from attaining psychological integrity, wholeness, the reconciliation and joining together of the disharmonious fragments of my mind. ADD seemed to explain many of my behavior patterns, thought processes, childish emotional reactions, my workaholism and other addictive tendencies, the sudden eruptions of bad temper and complete irrationality, the conflicts in my marriage, and my Jekyll and Hyde ways of relating to my children. So I thought, okay, now I finally understand myself here. Now, ADHD, when it's fully present, has got three characteristics. They don't all have to be there, but the three characteristics, the first one is poor impulse control. So people with ADHD lack impulse control, so that whatever arises for them, they act it out right away. You want something, you go for it. So the adult will do a lot of impulse buying. Children will interrupt you, or they'll blurt out whatever's in their minds, and so they say the inappropriate things very often, because there's no regulation of impulses. Now, impulse control, as I'll tell you, is the job of a certain part of the cortex, the gray matter of the brain. What other condition, by the way, in adults is characterized by poor impulse control? Saliently. Addiction. The addicts lack impulse control. In other words, you know that something is bad for you, but you still do it. In fact, if you do brain scans on drug addicts, the commonest finding is abnormality in the part of the brain that regulates impulses. So I'll say more about that later. The same thing is true for ADHD kids, autistic kids, and so on. They lack impulse control, which is one of the reasons that ADHD is such a significant risk factor for addiction, as I can tell you from my own personal behavior. So poor impulse control is one of the characteristics. So with that in mind then, I should also tell you before I read you the next paragraph, is that as a doctor, I was never one to be too quick with the prescription pad. I was always much more interested in talking with people and figuring out what we could do, you know, without pharmacology. If needed, I prescribed, of course, but that wasn't my first response. Except when it came to myself. With an impatience and lack of judgment characteristic of ADD, I had already begun to self-medicate, even before the formal diagnosis. A sense of urgency typifies attention deficit disorder, a desperation to do immediately whatever it is that one may desire at the moment, be it an object, an activity, or a relationship. And there was something else here too, well expressed by a woman who some months later came for help. It would be nice to get a break from myself for at least a little while, she said, a sentiment I fully understood. One longs to escape the fatiguing, ever-spinning, ever-churning mind. I took Ritalin at a higher than recommended initial dose on the very day I first heard about attention deficit disorder. Now, you can't do this, but I can, because I'm a doctor. So I just go to one of my buddies and, you know, Bev, Dr. Bev Spring at Palliative Care at Vancouver Hospital. Hey, Bev, I think I've got ADD. Can you give me some Ritalin? No, sure, how much do you want? This is medical secrets I'm giving here, but it's not good practice. But anyway, so, and on the principle that if a bit of Ritalin is good, then more Ritalin is even better, I took a higher than recommended initial dose. Within minutes, I felt euphoric and present. I experienced myself as full of insight and love. My wife thought I was acting weird. You look stoned was her immediate comment. Well, the Ritalin really helped me focus. I mean, it works within half an hour. And you know, I was focused. And within a couple of days, I was very depressed, because that's one of its potential side effects. Now, that doesn't mean it would have that impact on you, but it did on me, so I was really depressed. I have a depressive tendency anyway, so the Ritalin made me very depressed. And so I got off that, and I saw a psychiatrist. I was formally diagnosed with ADHD, and I was given dexedrine, another stimulant, which made me focused, and I became a much more efficient workaholic as a result, and so on and so forth. But what I didn't buy into right away was the medical idea that it's a genetic disorder. And I didn't buy into that despite the fact that two of my kids have been diagnosed subsequently. And I could see that right away. As soon as I understood it, I could see them. But I didn't buy into the genetic idea right from the beginning. I'll tell you why in a moment. But What are the other characteristics of ADD then? The other characteristics are physical hyperactivity, so that there's less self-control of the body, so that you're fidgety and doodling, and your legs are pumping all the time, you have trouble sitting still, you might have motor mouth, you have trouble stopping speaking, just less self-regulation. Now that doesn't have to be there, by the way, so that you can have ADD without the hyperactivity. And the boys tend to be more hyperactive, the girls tend to just be absent-minded, so that you don't notice the hyperactivity so much, so the girls don't get diagnosed so much. Because in a classroom, who's the one that gets noticed? It's the hyperactive boy who can't sit still. But the girl who sits there kind of tuned out at the back of the classroom, she doesn't cause any problems. And the squeaky wheel, or the wheel that's not squeaky doesn't get the grease, you know, as you know. So the second trait is hyperactivity. And the third trait is, so the first one is impulse control, so you interrupt people in conversation, you act out, you can't stand waiting in line, you jump ahead of people. And the third characteristic, and the salient one, is absent-mindedness. So you just, mind is literally absent. So your mind is not on what's in front of you. Which leads to poor finishing, because you start doing something, like you start doing your homework. Or in my case, as I described in the book, I start cleaning my room. You know, and of course, that distractibility, that absent-mindedness, creates chaos. Because mind's just not there. So then you go and clean your room, and full of good intentions, but because you're distractible, you know, you notice a book on the floor, and you, before you put it back on the shelf, you open up the book and you start reading it, and that starts another train of thought, and an hour later, your room is no better than it was. And then you start looking for a pair of socks, you know, or the other half of a pair of socks. You know, socks, how they disappear? By the way, I actually caught one the other day, and I know how they do it. You know how they do it? Socks. I was taking up the laundry from downstairs. As I got upstairs, I noticed that one sock had attached itself to my jacket. And I know what the plan was. The plan was that as soon as I went outside, it was going to jump off and run away. So they're clever, these socks. But anyway, what was I talking about? Oh my God. You go to clean your room and you don't finish it. So these kids start doing their homework. But they get distracted, so 5 minutes later they're onto something else. So poor attention skills, and then disorganization and the chaos. So these are the three characteristics. Poor impulse control, physical hyperactivity, which may or may not be there, and absent-mindedness. Now, the reason that I did buy into the genetic hypothesis is because they already understood something about absent-mindedness. It's not a disease. What is tuning out actually? It's an escape from too much stress. Now, if I were to stress you right now, you'd have three healthy options. What would they be, by the way? Three healthy options. You could walk away, you could just leave. That's a perfectly healthy option. What's another? Well, you could just tell me who... You could stop it. You could assert yourself. You're f***ed. That's the second. The third healthy option, if you couldn't fight back or escape because I was too powerful, but given that there's 100 people in a room with you, you could ask for help. So the three healthy options to a stressed situation is to fight back, or to assert yourself, to escape, or to seek help. Now, if those weren't available to you, that's when you would tune out. And you wouldn't tune out, by the way. You don't do it consciously. You don't say to yourself, I'm going to tune out now. You could. But for the most part, it's an unconscious brain defense. The brain has a limited number of defenses against overwhelming stress. Each of those defenses, as that article I quoted you from Pediatrics, you know, it begins as coping mechanisms, ends up as pathology. Each of those brain defenses, and I'll tell you the two later on, are adaptive in the short term, but negative in the long term. So what begins as a temporary state to deal with a particular situation becomes a long-term trait that now becomes pathological. So we go from a state to a trait. And this is how to understand childhood development disorders, that they go from states to traits. So in the short term, that tuning out may have helped me, but if it becomes a trait and it shows up all the time, now it gets in my way. So I understood that about tuning out. Now, In saying this, I'm not saying that the problem is not biological, by the way. What I'm saying is that the biology is actually shaped by the environment. But let me tell you a little bit about my own ADHD and what's at the basis of it. So I was born in 1944 in Budapest, Hungary, January, to Jewish parents. Now Hungary at that time had the only Jewish population in Eastern Europe that had yet not been exterminated. And then in March of 44, the Germans occupy Hungary. So the German army marches into Budapest, the Wehrmacht, when I'm 2 months old. Now, my father was away in forced labor. My mother and I were in Budapest when the Germans marched in. Now, the Jews of Hungary may not have known about the horrors of the camps and the genocide, but they certainly knew that the Germans were a grave threat. The day after the Wehrmacht occupied Budapest, my mother phones the pediatrician and says, "Would you please come and see Gabor, because he's crying all the time." And the pediatrician says, "Of course I will come, but I should tell you, all my Jewish babies are crying." Now, as an infant, as a two-month-old, what could I possibly have known about Nazis or Hitler or genocide or war? Nothing. What was I reacting to? My mother's stress, my mother's fear. Do I have an opportunity as an infant to seek help, escape, or to fight back? How do I deal with it? My brain tunes it out. It's not that I lie there as a two-month-old, oh, I gotta tune out. But that's an automatic brain mechanism, is to tune out when the stress is overwhelming. And let me read you a paragraph here from a California-based psychologist and spiritual teacher. And he says, "The child is very open and can feel the pain and suffering going on in its immediate environment. The child is aware of its own body and can also feel the tension, rigidity, and pain in the body of the mother or of anyone else he's with. If the mother is suffering, the baby suffers too. The pain never gets discharged." So when you have stressed parents, and we can talk about why parents are stressed, you actually have stressed infants. And one of the ways that a stressed infant will deal with the stress is to tune it out. What I'm suggesting to you, if we're seeing many, many more kids with ADHD these days, it's because parents are increasingly stressed. It's got nothing to do with genetics, or very little to do with genetics. I shouldn't say nothing. But the disease is not being passed on. First of all, it's not a disease. Secondly, it's not passed on genetically. What's actually happening is that the parenting environment is getting more and more stressed. So, any questions before we end the break? Yes, please.
Does that stress start in the womb?
That stress starts in the womb. I'll be telling you after the break that the stress on the mother that can affect the child actually begins in the womb. Any other questions?
If ADHD is brought on by stress, why in families do some children have ADHD and others do not?
Well, that's a good question. That's because no two kids have the same parents, that's why. Now let me tell you about my own family, okay? I'm the oldest one, I have two brothers. I told you about my first year of life, but I told you about the beginning of my first year of life. When I was 5 months old, my grandparents were killed in Auschwitz. My mother didn't know that, but she dreamt that the night they died, she dreamt that they died. And next morning, the breast milk dried up. And we lived under terrible conditions, as you can imagine. My father was away, and she didn't know he was dead or alive. Now, my next brother, Janosz, was born in 1946, a year and a half after the liberation of Hungary by the Russian army. And this is before the communist dictatorship took over. It was a time of relative peace and optimism. That's my brother Janosz. My second brother, George, whose name, by the way, is not George Mathey, but George Mate, because he was born in Canada, and he wants nothing to do with these funny European squiggles on names. He was born to my parents in Canada in 1958, when my father was 49 almost, and my mother almost 40, and they're immigrants in a new country, learning a language with two adolescent sons, isolated from their culture and their network and all that. Guess which two boys have been diagnosed with ADHD? Now, do you think the three brothers had the same parents?